Hello, this is John Callender again, continuing my unofficial commentary for The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, Extended Edition. Here I'm talking about Disc 2. If you're looking for my commentary on Disc 1, it's available on my website at www.lies.com/DVD. This new scene for the Extended Edition shows Aragorn at the grave of his mother, Gilraine. It's playing up the tension in his character's storyline with the whole "I do not want that power" line. "I've never wanted that power," that he'll be delivering in a moment. Which, to my mind, is a little false to the Aragorn of the book, where he doesn't really wrestle with doubts like that. Tolkien's Aragorn, I think, is already committed to the attempt to become king at this point in the story, though he sometimes doubts whether he'll be able to pull it off, with good reason, since the odds are very much against him. For the movie, though, I think the filmmakers wanted Aragorn to travel a greater emotional distance on screen, so they give us this early self-doubt. I'm not sure it works terribly well, and I'd probably blame Viggo Mortensen's acting abilities more than anything else for that failure. I respect and admire the character of Aragorn, and I respect and admire Viggo Mortensen and what he accomplished in taking on this role and giving it his all. It's just that for me, on some level, I find his all coming up a little short. Mortensen is a poet, a serious photographer. He's a person with the courage to speak out publicly about his political views, views that I share, for the most part. He's someone who gets referred to as a Renaissance man, with more justification than is often the case when that term gets applied. But I don't think he's really a great actor. He reminds me more of someone like a Gregory Peck. If you cast him right as an honest, thoughtful character, he'll give you a great performance, because he is an honest, thoughtful person, and it comes through on screen. And I think he is well cast as Aragorn, but sometimes his acting just comes up a little short for me. And this thing he does with the kingship is, this approach avoidance behavior is an example of that. Now here we've just seen Bilbo, played by Ian Holm, transforming into the orc momentarily. Of course, that gets a huge jump from the audience every time. And that gesture that Ian Holm does afterwards, where he's sort of shielding his head, it always reminds me of Anthony Hopkins' gesture in Howard's End, in the scene where Emma Thompson has confronted him about his past, and he sort of shields himself that way. I think this is just great acting, and it's a good contrast to what I was speaking of a moment ago with Viggo Mortensen's acting ability. I think Ian Holm brings a tremendous amount to every scene that he's in. Liv Tyler talks about how, for this shot, it was done fairly early on, and her expression is kind of goofy, that she's sort of an uncertain Arwen in this scene, not really the same strong-willed, resolute Arwen that they settled on later on in the filming process. The line that Frodo's going to deliver here in a moment about which way is Mordor, left or right, I guess is meant as a joke for the Tolkien-obsessed. I'm not sure. But for me, it rings a little hollow, since it's pretty clear that the Frodo of the books, at least, would have known perfectly well which way to turn at this point. But in general, I have to say that the orientation and the general appearance of the landscape in the movie is consistently accurate in terms of recreating the geography that Tolkien described so thoroughly. It's one of the real triumphs, I think, of how the filmmakers stayed true to the books, and I really appreciate that. There's again, this sort of uncertain moment between Aragorn and Arwen coming on top of the bridge scene that we saw at the end of Disc 1, certainly. But to go back to the geography and the landscape as shown in the films, some things, of course, the movies just couldn't do. You couldn't include all the characters, all the dialogue from the books. But in a 2-second helicopter shot of the Fellowship walking through some hills with mountains in the background, you could make sure that what was shown on screen matched Tolkien's map and his descriptions as best they could. And it's the same idea as what they did with their obsessive set decoration and the props they used in settings like Bag End and Rivendell. There was always a richness of detail, lovingly extrapolated from Tolkien, that gave the film a real sense of authenticity. This sequence of the characters cresting the hilltop was released as part of the first teaser trailer. There were a number of trailers released in theaters and on the internet, and I'm sure I wasn't the only person watching them over and over again. It was just incredibly exciting as a fan of the books to see that shot. We were seeing those characters come to life on screen for the first time in those few seconds of film, and they were so perfectly drawn. Their expressions as they crested that rise and looked out on the prospect ahead of them were so true to their characters at that point in the story that it just gave me chills every time I watched it. I didn't know how I was going to wait, be able to wait for the movies. In a moment here, we're going to have the first instance of a recurring theme in which they ignore Legolas's hypersensitive elf awareness. He's worried already about the oncoming cloud of Crabbein, the birds from Dunland who are spies for Saruman. This sequence of the hobbits fighting with Boromir is a lot of fun, and it does help explain to some degree about how the hobbits suddenly become such adept swordsmen later on in some of the action sequences. It, you know, gives some explanation, of course, as they're traveling for months, actually, at this point in the story. They're learning. These are CGI birds, as I learned from the commentary tracks. But they certainly work well for me. As I watch that scene, they look like real birds to me. And I'm a lifelong bird watcher, as well as a lifelong Tolkien obsessive, so I'm very impressed with the detail and the realism they achieve. Here, where we're going to see the ring picked up in the foreground, it's actually an example of some more interesting work the filmmakers did with the notion of scale. That's actually a stunt ring there. It's about, well, I don't know, 8 or 10 inches across. You can see a cast member polishing it in one of the documentaries on the additional discs. And I think it does help, really. They were always trying to, you know, infuse the ring with power and a sense of menace, and making it look as big as possible in that close-up really made that work, and it makes the shot much simpler, you know, certainly than trying to get a good-looking shot with some kind of macro lens. This scene, by the way, bothered a lot of fans, that we show Boromir actually holding the ring, if only by its chain. It never happens in the book, but I think it helps, especially for those in the audience, again, who are unfamiliar with the story. Tolkien could, and did, go on for page after page about the inner torment characters suffered as the ring was working on their minds. But in a movie, you have to find a way to show that, and so they did with this scene, and I think it works well. We also get a heightening of the tension between Aragorn and Boromir, excuse me, and a reminder via Aragorn's hand on his sword hilt there of how serious the stakes with the ring are. Some more good classic horror movie Christopher Lee here, down in his lair. The actors who shot this scene all talked about how awful it was to film, which, given the many hardships they faced during their 15 months of shooting, must be saying a lot. They're on a soundstage that was actually very hot and stuffy, when the snow consisting of some sort of icky little plastic bits being blown into their eyes and their throats and everywhere. And if you're a good actor, I guess you find a way to use that discomfort, you know, letting it channel into your acting as you convey this sense of struggling through a snow-filled mountain pass. But it does sound really, really awful. Legolas, a moment ago, of course, we saw him walking on top of the snow, which is described in Tolkien. And they do remain faithful to that. Somehow in Tolkien's version of that, I always pictured Legolas as smaller, sort of more like the Keebler elf kind of elf, you know, which seems to make more sense in terms of dancing across the snow. But it works fine there in the movie. That shot as we swooped past Saruman, if you listen to the commentaries, you can look very carefully, and on his left hand you can actually see a bandage. Christopher Lee was injured on that day of filming. I really love that shot, by the way, as they swooped past the top of Orthanc and you see the clouds flying northward. In a moment, we're going to cut back to Christopher Lee, and he'll be paging through a book as he speaks to the off-camera Gandalf about the dangers of Moria. And for some reason, the foreshadowing of Moria, of the Balrog that they give us from that with that page in Saruman's book, just always looked really odd to me. But anyway, just the colors, the style of the artwork just seemed very out of place in a book that Saruman would be reading in Middle-earth. But maybe that's just me. Here we'll see it in just a moment. This, of course, is from Tolkien's own drawing of the entrance to Moria that Saruman was looking at there. But this shot, I don't know, it just seems odd to me. Maybe it's not, I don't know. This discussion, by the way, this part of the story, as Tolkien gives it, it's Gandalf who argues pretty much from the beginning that they should go through Moria. And Aragorn, who, having a premonition that such a journey would be dangerous, specifically for Gandalf, argues against going there and for trying the Pass of Caradhras first. And I suppose the idea of having Gandalf argue for Caradhras and Aragorn arguing for turning back, as they do in the movie, with Frodo making the final call, was meant as a way to give Frodo a more central role in moving the plot forward. But it feels a little off to me compared to the book's version of that sequence, and it undercuts, I think, a little bit the sacrifice that Gandalf makes in the books, going open-eyed into this danger of Moria, rather than, as the movie gives it, almost being compelled to, grudgingly, by Frodo's decision. But at the same time, I think I can understand that the movie needs to make things obvious in the interest of clarity, again for that audience that doesn't know the story already. The subtlety of the book's version, where Gandalf is arguing to go through Moria despite the danger to himself, and Aragorn is attempting to avoid their going there through concern for Gandalf's safety, could well have been confusing for people unfamiliar with the books. Part of the cracking the code process that the screenwriters talked about a lot in adapting the story was lessening that cognitive burden for those new to Tolkien by simplifying and straightening out some of the more complicated plot twists. So if Moria is dangerous to Gandalf, then show Gandalf being scared of it. If he's willing to go there despite the danger, show him, as they do, expressing that willingness grudgingly, so we don't miss the fact that it is in fact dangerous to him and that he's aware of that. This shot of the entrance to Moria is another one of those shots that became available before the film was actually released, somewhat closer to the film's release in this case, close to the time that the movie was at Cannes, I think. And again, it looked so perfect from a fan's perspective, being based as it was on Tolkien's own illustration, which they showed us in that book of Saruman's a moment ago, that it was just tremendously exciting to see this. Sam's going to be taking leave of Bill the pony in a moment, which was a nice reinsertion in the extended edition, with Aragorn referring to Bill the pony by name, which obviously is really there just as a treat for fans of the book. Ian McKellen has published a lot of really fascinating tidbits about his experiences making the films on his own website, and I found it interesting in one of the email exchanges he posted there that he actually was ignorant as to Bill the Pony's ultimate fate after being set free in this scene. McKellen expressed the opinion in one of these email exchanges that sadly Bill was probably eaten by wolves, which certainly is the impression you get from this passage in the book. But as many helpful obsessives quickly pointed out to him toward the end of The Return of the King, when the hobbits are on their homeward journey, they meet Bill the Pony, alive and well, in Bree. And I think McKellen's response to that information showed a certain degree of embarrassment, along with amusement at these obsessives, which is fine. It makes sense to me, though, in hindsight, there goes Bill, that McKellen wouldn't have known that. Many people have talked about how Ian McKellen was the actor who was always referring to a dog-eared copy of Tolkien on the set, and more than once argued for and succeeded in getting a dialogue change to match the book more closely. But he had never read the books before being cast, and I think what this whole incident with Bill the Pony reveals is that his reading of Tolkien was focused pretty narrowly on the specific scenes in which Gandalf appeared, or at least those parts of the book that were actually finding their way into the script for the movies. Christopher Lee, of course, didn't need a copy of Tolkien on the set, since, like all good obsessives, he was intimately familiar with the entire book and could probably quote passages from memory, but Christopher Lee wasn't in that scene. There's an interesting bit of suspense here for people who already knew the story. They're entering Moria, and here they're actually inside already. But Frodo hasn't been grabbed yet by the Watcher in the Waters. Are they leaving the Watcher in the Waters out? You know, they couldn't leave it out. It's just a little extra tension for the fans, a little extra uncertainty for those who are so certain they know the story. And of course they don't leave the Watcher in the Waters out. There's no way that Peter Jackson could resist an action sequence like that. And it is a great action sequence. Fairly true to the book, at least initially, in the part that'll come up in just a moment, where Frodo gets grabbed first, and Sam is the first to run to his aid and hacks at the tentacles to free him. But then it quickly spins out into a version of the sequence that goes well beyond the book into this full-on Peter Jackson monster sequence, very reminiscent of Ray Harryhausen claymation animation, you know, like in the Clash of the Titans and movies like that, which was, of course, the young Peter Jackson's original ambition as a filmmaker. He wanted to do those sorts of special effects and just be a special effects person. And it was only after focusing on that for a while, he's said, that he realized that doing visual effects to tell someone else's story wasn't going to be nearly as fulfilling and nearly as much fun as doing them as part of telling his own story. And here we get a good look at the Watcher in the Waters at the end there. Or certainly more of a look than you ever get in the books, where it's just these tentacles writhing up out of the water. This whole Moria sequence was shown at Cannes, at the Cannes Film Festival, before the movie's release, and I think that was the time that interest in the movies really picked up and began to really make a buzz in the mainstream audience. We obsessives have been drooling over rumors and leaked still photos and brief clips from trailers for more than a year at that point. But now the rest of the world, or at least the portion of it that was lucky enough to see that footage at Cannes, got a taste of what was coming. And by all accounts, they were just uniformly blown away by it. I wasn't one of those people, obviously. I don't move in those circles, but I certainly envied them. And at that point, the job of waiting for the movie's release just got that much harder. Of course, there's a long history of Tolkien obsession on the net. people playing the cast The Lord of the Rings movie game on Usenet, going back probably 20 years or more. And when it first came out that the movie was actually looking like it was going to be made, there was immediately a lot of excitement. But there was some fear, too, which I shared. You know, every book I loved as a child growing up that had been made into a movie had always sucked. at least in comparison to the book. It was like a natural law of the universe. The Jungle Book in Disney's cartoon form sucked compared to the book. It was just a different story. Swiss Family Robinson sucked. Dr. Doolittle, taking away nothing from Rex Harrison, it was nothing like the original. It was very, very different, and in some ways diminished by the process of being adapted. And I just grew up having my heart torn out by grossly inadequate film treatments of my favorite books. And that was the groundwork that laid the foundation for my reaction to the news that this movie was going to be made. But with every hint that came out about the movies, this kernel of hope began to form inside me, and I'm sure inside every other ardent Tolkien fan. Wow, this could actually be good. The Tolkien illustrators they chose to help with the art direction, Alan Lee and John Howe, were the two illustrators whose paintings always felt perfect to an obsessed Tolkien fan, the way they pictured Middle-earth. And the care they were taking in things like planting the Shire location a year in advance and then letting it grow into a natural state for filming. And the bits and pieces we saw in the early trailers, all those sorts of things were hints that it might actually be good. But there was no way to know. There was just no way to be sure until we actually saw it with our own eyes. Because you didn't know, you can make a trailer that looks great for a movie that's total crap. You just pick out those few moments and put them together. So we couldn't be sure. But with every piece of news, the possibility seemed to get a little better. Here we've got another minimal shot of Gollum, sort of just teasing us with a few quick looks at him, as they did in the prologue, since the filmmakers really weren't sure how they were going to depict him. So they were leaving themselves some room down the road for the subsequent two movies. This passage coming up, in which Gandalf talks about the whole conversation here, in fact, it always resonated powerfully with me when I read the book, the part about pity, and it's been an important part of my own thinking as I think about issues like capital punishment. It's not for us to decide line. And again, this whole conversation, it comes more or less intact from the book. It happens in the book when Gandalf returns to the Shire after his researches at Minas Tirith and confirms that Frodo's ring is in fact the One Ring. On first viewing the movie, I noticed that those lines were missing there in the Shire sequence, and I was disappointed by that. And then I was tremendously gratified to see the lines show up here in Moria. It's just another example of the filmmakers finding a way. Knowing as fans themselves, knowing what parts of the story were important and finding a way to work them in a way that served the interest of the movie, and didn't interrupt the action with too much talking at an inappropriate place. And just more great direction by Peter Jackson, knowing to close in nice and tight on Ian McKellen's face. And Ian McKellen, with all those prosthetics, the big nose and everything, the bags under the eyes and everything they did to him, still finding a way to make it work just amazingly well, as an actor, delivering those emotions and just carrying us along. In a moment, we're going to see this shot of Moria, and it's certainly impressive. The scale of Moria that they convey is impressive, as is the design team's zeal in staying firmly rooted in Tolkien. Here's Tolkien's description that comes just after Gandalf gives his line of "I will now risk a little real light." He writes, "He raised his staff, and for a brief instant there was a blaze like a flash of lightning. Great shadows sprang up and fled, and for a second they saw a vast roof far above their heads, upheld by many mighty pillars hewn of stone. Before them and on either side stretched a huge empty hall, its black walls, polished and smooth as glass, flashed and glittered." So much had to be pruned away in trimming the story from 1,000 pages of text down to a few hours of movie. events, characters, songs, poems, history, all of it cut away down to this core story of the ring's destruction. But one thing the filmmakers could carry over intact from the book was Tolkien's descriptions of Middle-earth, the mountains and forests, the towers and caverns, and they're all here, recreated in sets, in painted backdrops, in miniatures with an incredible amount of detail, or even in just the computer-generated images, painstakingly crafted for just a second or two of screen time. And here we are in Balin's tomb with the Book of Mazarbul. And a good example of a prop that is described in detail by Tolkien and pictured in perfect detail by the filmmakers. And of course the book's version of this passage that Gandalf reads is longer, but they certainly capture the flavor of it. And, of course, a moment ago we again ignored the warnings of Legolas. This was a deft touch by the screenwriters, the way they've moved the event in the book where Pippin drops a stone into the well the night before, and they move it here with a much more dramatic example. But again, they're finding a way to satisfy the Tolkien fans by putting more of the book into the small span of screen time they had available, while always serving that need of the larger movie audience, moving that plot forward, keeping them engaged. And this is a great look that Billy Boyd gives, the little start he makes at the last big boom. More great dialogue straight out of the book. This extended fight sequence coming up in the Chamber of Mazarbul is a great Peter Jackson action sequence. In fact, I'd really go as far as saying it's one of the great movie action sequences ever, which I realize is saying a lot, but if you just look at how well it works, it's just very impressive. It doesn't just show a bunch of people fighting each other, but it actually advances the story in a number of ways. And I think just having the sequence all make sense, you know, in the midst of so much chaos is really impressive. You can follow the whole fight, and on subsequent viewing, you can see even more of what's going on. You can basically trace out the experience of each of the principal characters through the entire sequence. You know, the way they build the tension, it's just great stuff. There's a great Gimli moment there. You know, it's just indomitable courage he has, especially here, you know, defending the tomb of his relative against these hated enemies of dwarves since time immemorial. And our first chance to see just what sort of archer Legolas really is. One thing I didn't appreciate until watching the extended features on this DVD set is how iterative a process the making of this movie was, how many steps there were. I guess I'd really thought of movie making as comprising about four basic steps. You had a treatment and a script, and then you shot the raw footage, and then you edited that footage into final form. And in fact, of course, there are a lot of additional intermediate steps that are possible, and this movie used many of them. In particular, you know, the whole movie was storyboarded, and then the storyboards were assembled into an animatic, with the storyboard frames being animated together, and voice actor dialogue being added on top. And that step was carried even farther in some parts of the film, like this one, with computer-based pre-visualization or pre-vis, in which they could make a rough CGI version of the scene and fly a virtual camera around in it and really work out in a lot of detail what would happen from one shot to the next. There was a lot about that process in the documentaries on disc 3 and 4 for this set. And if you haven't watched those, I really recommend them highly. All of the documentaries there are really interesting and really a cut above the sort of more mainstream documentaries that we had in the original DVD release of the theatrical version. Here we're going to get the first of many great Legolas moments. Something that they talk about in the commentaries is, and in interviews the filmmakers do, is something that they sort of developed as they went along, this notion that Legolas has these elf senses and these elf abilities and this grace and body awareness and gymnastics ability that they explored. And it occurs in the book in a few places, walking across a tightrope in effect and some other things like that. But in the movie they found a way to realize it visually in a really interesting way. And Peter Jackson likes to talk about the cave troll as being not such a bad guy, really. Just someone who's fallen in with the wrong crowd. He's mentioned in a lot of interviews I've heard about the idea of the cave troll's mother waiting for him at home and him just never coming back, and what a sad moment that is. Which is cute, I think. More great action here. Aragorn leaping in and saving Frodo's life yet again. Just going mano a mano with the cave troll. And keeping ahead of it for a little bit until he gets flung into the wall there. I love how the final killing of the cave troll coming up really just takes everything the Fellowship has left. They've been fighting and doing a pretty good job against the long odds of this orc attack so far, but now roused by the presumed skewering of Frodo, they all just go berserk in this final outburst of violence. Merry and Pippin jump on his head, and Merry stabs the cave troll in the back of the neck, causing him to raise his head and bellow, at which point Legolas takes advantage of the momentary opening to shoot him from inside his mouth, such that he, deals with the problem he had earlier where he was, shooting at the head of the cave troll and the arrows were just bouncing off his thick skull. And here we go. Now, that is a Ray Harryhausen monster sequence. Certainly in the best traditions of that work. I'm not sure for a person unfamiliar with the story how much real tension there is in that moment before you find out that Frodo is in fact alive. I don't know, it's in some ways a little bit of a regret, and Peter Jackson talks about this regret, that I cannot watch these movies without knowing the story. I can't just sit down and see it fresh for the first time. But that's okay. I'll certainly take them even with the inherent lack of surprise that being so familiar with the story gives me. This part coming up in a moment where they're going to be surrounded by the orcs, and then all the orcs are going to run away at the approach of the Balrog. It is kind of silly, I think. It's one of those cliched movie elements that Peter Jackson is perfectly willing to use. It's the sort of thing that could never really happen in the real world, but we've seen it in movies over and over and over again because it works visually. It's familiar. I read accounts of that sequence before I'd actually seen the movie as part of my obsessive seeking out of all possible spoiler information. I gave in to that temptation early on and came to see the little red spoiler warnings on the OneRing.net as not warnings of things to be avoided, but as shining beacons to be pursued. Anyway, so I'd heard about this scene before I saw it, but watching the movie, it wasn't as cheesy as I'd worried it would be. It's really just scaffolding. It's a supporting structure on which to hang the elements that really work well. That hideous orc face and Pippin's reaction shot of just sheer terror, and in a moment here the way that Gimli, or actually I guess we saw that part already, the way that Gimli has this mistaken belief that the orcs have been frightened off by him. And then the Fellowship members' reaction shots here as they realize that the orcs were frightened off by something even more frightening. It's a way of giving the audience, again, the sort of familiar hook, something they can understand immediately because they've seen it before in other movies, and then fleshing it out with new creative touches to maintain their interest. It's more of that balancing act that I've been talking about, that the filmmakers did in putting this story together. And by and large, I think Peter Jackson maintains that balance really, really well. Now, with that being said, and speaking of balancing acts, we now come to what is probably my least favorite example of a Peter Jackson addition to the story. This steps sequence, and especially the tottering column, it's something new. It's not part of the book, but it's similar, at least, to a passage in the book that describes them having to jump across a crack earlier in their journey through Moria. But the sequence has always bothered me on some level, for pretty much the same reasons I just talked about in connection with the surrounded by orcs who then run away sequence. In this case, for me personally, it's just a little too Perils of Pauline. But I know a lot of people, my wife included, who are Tolkien fans and who really think that that sequence is great. So, there you have it. I guess it's partly just a matter of personal taste. I mean, it certainly does give you that sense of jeopardy. And it's believably depicted, them jumping across the crack and the difficulties they have, and these arrows coming in. This shot is certainly great fun. The nobody tosses a dwarf line coming up in a moment always gets a big laugh in the theater, and I guess some tension relief was warranted there, though it certainly would yank me out of Middle Earth to hear a contemporary reference to dwarf tossing like that if I weren't already just kind of waiting myself for this staircase part to end so I can get back to the real story. And of course it does set up a nice laugh in the Two Towers in the Helm's Deep sequence when Gimli tells Aragorn, "Don't tell the elf." This part here, well, in a moment, when, in particular, when Aragorn tells Frodo to lean forward, the the implication that Aragorn and Frodo are causing the column to fall forward. For me, that's just where my personal cheese-o-meter kicks over into the red zone. But again, I know people who really like it. And the falling staircase that comes immediately after that, the shot of it falling down and crashing down into the depths of Moria, certainly does give you a great sense of the monumental scale of Moria. And it's almost worth all the cheesy stuff just to get that one shot, that one special effect shot. But any disappointment I'm feeling over the cheesy staircase scene at this point in the movie is immediately swept away by what follows, In a film full of amazing achievements in adapting Tolkien's language to visual form, the Balrog reigns supreme. This whole sequence on the bridge with Gandalf and the Balrog is a huge high point. Arguably, it's the emotional high point of the entire Fellowship of the Ring. And they handle it so perfectly, so faithfully. I think Peter Jackson knew he was dealing with a favorite moment, one that everyone who's ever read the book was going to remember vividly. And wisely, he really didn't mess with it at all. And again, the Balrog, described by Tolkien more in terms of just hints about what it looked like. Tolkien fans argued for decades over whether or not the Balrog has wings. How do you depict that? In a movie, he has to either have them or not. But they actually do a great job of giving us wings that sort of melt into smoke and shadow and back again. It's just very, very well handled. The one change that they make from the book in this sequence is how they show Gandalf close in, almost whispering, "Fly, you fools," at the end. In the book's version of that, Gandalf shouts that as he's already falling. But I think the way they did it here certainly works much better on film. And I'm just completely satisfied with it. The way the Balrog's whip comes up at just the last possible second is another one of those moments of extra added tension for those knowing the story. Knowing it's coming, but getting to the point where you almost think, it's not going to happen. Like the Watcher in the Waters grabbing Frodo at the entrance to Moria. And the way Gandalf fades out there in almost a Christ-like pose, his arms spread wide, obvious symbolism. And just powerful stuff. And so they continue into this shot of them exiting the east gate of Moria out into the daylight. It's very, very good stuff. This exterior shot where we see the Fellowship emerging onto the rocks outside Moria. The actors are all computer-generated here. They're just CGI Fellowship members. And on the big screen in the theater, the shot's actually kind of weak. You can see some problems with Legolas's shadow. At least I've always noticed it, and having seen it once, I end up focusing on it a lot. I do think they do a great job here, just depicting the sorrow that they all feel at the loss of Gandalf. Philippa Boyens compliments Peter Jackson in the commentary track for the direction he gave Elijah Wood for this upcoming shot where Elijah turns around. She recalls Peter Jackson telling Elijah that he wanted the audience to be scared by his grief, and I think Elijah does a good job. It's one of the younger, less experienced actors in the film. I think his acting is certainly worthwhile. It holds up his end. I wouldn't put it on a par with some of the people I find really impressive, but I think that's understandable. There's some more shots that, again, echo very well the descriptions of this landscape that they travel through in this part of the book. The Miramir, Kelad Zerim. Just giving us a brief shot of it is great stuff for the fans. The great irony, of course, about the warnings we're going to hear from Gimli here about the sorceress in these woods is that it's Gimli, far more than anyone else in the company, who will truly fall under Galadriel's spell, falling deeply in love with her. And it's a love that will last for the rest of his life. Gimli's relationship with Galadriel is an important side story in the book, but it isn't given a lot of detail. But you can pick out some more aspects of it in the appendices, and I've always liked it. I always thought it was a really powerful part of the story. Not so much like it's a great love story or anything, but just the notion of these longtime enemies, dwarves and elves, especially these dwarves and elves in this region of Middle-earth, have sort of a long-running animosity. And the book makes that even more clear than the film does here. And the setting aside of those differences and the peace that's made between Galadriel and Gimli is a very moving part of the book to me. The shots of Gimli that we see here are fairly shocking for someone used to the theatrical release, in that the makeup is completely different. He doesn't have the helmet on, and the voice is the same, but you're looking at him saying, "Oh my gosh, who is that?" They describe in the commentaries how, in fact, there were different stages of the makeup they tried to use on John Rhys-Davies as Gimli, and this was an earlier approach to the makeup that they ended up not using for the film as it was released, but they liked these scenes for the extended edition, so they brought them back, despite Gimli's looking a little out of place, or a lot out of place. To return for a moment to this whole notion of Gimli and Galadriel, in the appendices at the end of Return of the King, Tolkien, in the guise of the Hobbit historians to whom Bilbo's book has been handed down, gives the high points of the later lives of each of the members of the Fellowship after the main story ends. And one of the very last things in chronological terms is this passage: "But when King Alessar," that is Aragorn, "gave up his life, Legolas followed at last the desire of his heart and sailed over sea. We have heard tell that Legolas took Gimli, Glóin's son, with him because of their great friendship, greater than any that has been between elf and dwarf. If this is true, then it is strange indeed that a dwarf should be willing to leave Middle-earth for any love, or that the Eldar should receive him, or that the lords of the West should permit it. But it is said that Gimli went also out of desire to see again the beauty of Galadriel, and it may be that she, being mighty among the Eldar, obtained this grace for him." So in a moment, we'll be arriving at the flat, and we'll see Cate Blanchett as Galadriel. And she's just amazing in this role. She just nails it. And supposedly, from the commentaries by the actors and the interviews they've done, she nails it in like one take. Many of the other actors, particularly the younger ones, talk a lot about the months and months of training and preparation that they underwent. And Cate Blanchett, who's, you know, there relatively little, she only has a few scenes, shows up, you know, one day on the set, walks on, and bam, she's Galadriel right out of the gate. But then Cate Blanchett has always been an amazing chameleon as an actress. If you compare Galadriel to her roles in movies like The Shipping News or The Gift, or Elizabeth for that matter, she just disappears into those characters. Her promotional junket joke that she made about how she took this part mainly because she always wanted to wear elf ears, it got old for me after the third or fourth time I heard it, but I can forgive her anything for her portrayal of Galadriel here. She's such an important, powerful character in the story, albeit one that has relatively little time on screen, as it were, in the book. But you definitely get the sense of her power and her magical abilities, which you learn more about over the course of the book and the movie. In particular, that she wields one of the three magical elven rings. Here in a moment, we're going to get the wooing of Gimli. A moment I was definitely looking forward to as I watched the movie. And it does deliver it in a way that's that's satisfying even for an obsessive. I could have wished it went on just a little bit longer. But they go immediately after the look at Gimli and the pronouncing of the place names in his dwarvish tongue. She just does that shot perfectly. It evokes the passage in the book really well. But they go immediately from that to her also very memorable interaction from the book with Boromir, which again I could wish was drawn out a little longer on screen. But that's me, and I can understand the needs of the movie to be moving along. This sudden cut we're going to do in a moment to Cate Blanchett's eyes in close up with her "one who has seen the eye" line. It still makes me jump every time I see it, which I realize is the intention. It's kind of a cheap trick, but I can see where Peter Jackson wanted to increase that sense of jeopardy in the story. Here it comes, if you're in synchronization with my commentary. And there it is. The widening of the eyes. In the books, the Lothlorien sequence serves for the reader, as well as for the characters of the Fellowship, as a respite. It's a chance to recuperate. They have to grieve over Gandalf. But in the movie, Peter Jackson has said he really felt compelled to keep the tension building, and keep it, keep the movie rising towards its climax, and hence he really focuses more on the scary side of Galadriel, which she has certainly in the books, and it's an important part of her character. But in the movie, it's pretty much all of her character that we see. It's certainly pretty much all we see of her character in the theatrical release, or it's the main focus of it, at least. In the extended edition here, there's a little more that we'll talk about later, of the nice Galadriel. Here's another case of Sean Bean stealing a scene that he has here with Aragorn. Not in any bad way. I mean, it's terrific acting, and Viggo Mortensen is, I think, doing his best to carry his end, and does an adequate job. But as I watch this, and certainly as I watch the movie more and more, I focus more and more on Sean Bean's portrayal of Boromir, and enjoy it more. It's surprising to me, given that it is a pretty big departure from how I read the book, that this scene turns out to be one of my favorite scenes from the movie. This is a speech that Boromir never gives as such in the book. The description of Minas Tirith that he's going to give in a moment is from Tolkien's description of what Pippin sees as he arrives at the city in the Two Towers. But it's certainly a speech that Boromir could have given if given the chance. And I give the filmmakers credit. I think I see the hand of Philippa Boyens and Fran Walsh, maybe, in crafting these lines. The film gives Boromir the chance to express this sentiment. And it's a beautiful moment, and one that really helps explain Boromir's motivation and helps redeem him for the betrayal that, of course, he'll be guilty of later on in the story. You notice, I always notice there that Howard Shore, who's a horn player originally, the composer of the score for Lord of the Rings, he can't resist punctuating Boromir's silver trumpets line a moment ago with some heroic horns in the background. This whole scene here with Kate, the sequence with Cate Blanchett and Frodo in the Mirror of Galadriel. I don't think Elijah Wood as an actor really keeps up with Cate Blanchett here, acting wise, and it's particularly noticeable to me in this part coming up in just a moment when she speaks slowly. It sounds eerie and otherworldly to me. And when Elijah Wood replies, speaking equally slowly, he just sounds like a dork. I'm sorry, but he really does. I don't know. Again, it may just be me. I was intrigued by the bare feet. They focused on Galadriel's bare feet as she was walking down the steps a minute ago. I'm not sure why that struck me as so interesting as a first-time viewer of the movie. That's just something I'd never really thought about. I believe Tolkien does describe Galadriel as barefoot, but it had never formed part of my visualization of her character as I read the books, and then to have Peter Jackson focus on it as she entered this scene was interesting. The things that Frodo is going to see in the mirror in a moment are more concrete in the movie than they are in the books, in terms of their meaning. In the books, he sees isolated moments from the long history of the ring, and scattered visions that only really make sense after you've read the whole story. And in the book, Sam is also part of the scene and looks into the mirror first. And Galadriel tells him when he looks in, just before he looks into it, "The mirror shows many things, and not all have yet come to pass. Some never come to be, unless those that behold the visions turn aside from their path to prevent them. The mirror is dangerous as a guide of deeds." But the movie's version of the mirror, as supplemented by Galadriel's explanation, is a lot less ambiguous. I'm not bothered by that change so much. It's one of those things where I understand the needs of the movie, and I'm perfectly happy with the scene as delivered. I think there's some great acting as Cate Blanchett, deals with her desire for the ring and all of these events that are coming up in the next few minutes here. But it is something that I enjoy about the books, and I think I'll continue to enjoy about the books. The movie certainly doesn't lessen my enjoyment of the books any. Thanks, by the way, to the French and Saunders parody of the Fellowship of the Ring, which I mentioned in my commentary on Disc One. I can no longer watch the way that Galadriel and Frodo slip into and out of telepathic speech in this sequence without finding it just very amusing, because of the way that they do it in that scene is really very funny. The test, Frodo's testing of Galadriel here, and Galadriel's response to the test, has a different feeling in the movie than I always thought it had in the book. In the book, I never thought Galadriel was really being tested. I thought it was more that she was pretending for Frodo's benefit to think about taking the ring, but that the outcome was never really in doubt. There's a teasing quality to it, at least as I've read the passage in my head while reading it over the years. And in the movie version, it's much. I get the sense, after these moments here, where she really did feel that it was a real test, that she was surprised by her passing the test. I really love, by the way, unlike some obsessive fans whose opinions I've read, I really love the special effects as she delivered her treacherous as the sea lines there, the way they illuminate her and change her appearance. In a moment, we're gonna cut to Christopher Lee, but I want to stick with Galadriel and just talk about this a little more. I'm not sure how apparent it is to those who watch the movies without being familiar with Tolkien, but Galadriel is extremely old and powerful. She's been in Middle-earth far longer than Gandalf, and there's the shot of the Elven Ring, which we have in the extended edition, not in the theatrical release. She's been in Middle-earth far longer than Gandalf and Elrond. She's actually Elrond's mother-in-law, because Elrond married her daughter, Galibrien, which makes Galadriel Arwen's grandmother. But more than that, her memory stretches back to the great events of the First Age, events in which she was an important participant. It's no accident that she's the one who narrates that opening prologue and is shown there wearing one of the elven rings. To her, all these events, all the events narrated in the prologue dealing with the creation of the rings, all of that is relatively recent history. So in light of that, for me, the idea that she's actually being tested in that sequence where Frodo offers her the ring and she eventually refuses it, that she's actually in doubt herself as to the outcome of the test, and then visibly surprised at her having passed it afterward, it just seems a little less true to her character than the way it's treated in the books. But in this, as in many places in the story, given a choice between an interpretation that would heighten the sense of dramatic tension and jeopardy and one that wouldn't, Peter Jackson chose the one that would. I think it's consistent, too, with the choices they made throughout the movies, not just the Fellowship of the Ring, but the subsequent two films as well, to always do whatever they could to play up the power of the ring. They wanted, you know, when a major character was tempted by the ring, they wanted that struggle to be visible and strong, and it does drive a lot of the inherent drama of the storyline, and they needed to show that. It creates a lot of problems for them in the Two Towers, with the character of Faramir in particular, and I'll talk about that if and when I get to doing an unauthorized commentary of the Two Towers. But if you have followed those issues among the fan communities online, then you probably have a sense already of where I'm going to go in those comments. This gift-giving scene that we have is great to have back in full, pretty much straight as it is given in the book here in the extended edition. Personally, I could live without Pippin's burp here, especially in that the audio seems to have even a bit of a fart mixed in with it. I'm all for Peter Jackson's use of humor to broaden Tolkien's appeal for a mainstream audience, but I think I'd probably have to come down on the side of someone like Christopher Tolkien, the tireless defender of his father's legacy against barbarian popularizers, and draw the line at fart humor. I prefer to see my Tolkien without that element. Martin Sokka says, as Celeborn gets some additional camera time in this extended sequence, which is nice. He's always getting short shrift in the book as well as in the movie, playing second fiddle to his powerful elf queen wife. And here we have a little manly bonding, handing over this knife that's going to play a prominent role in this film's cinematic climax. Again, more of the gift giving. Sam misses out on getting his gift from the books, which was the box of magical earth from Galadriel's garden. And since we've done away with the scouring of the Shire sequence at the end of the stories, it certainly makes sense to eliminate that. At least he does get the elven rope, which is not given to him by Galadriel in the books, but is mentioned. He notices as they're packing it, the elves just sort of give it to him as they're packing the boats, and he talks with some other elves about it. Tolkien has Sam describe Galadriel this way to Faramir in The Two Towers, in a scene that we don't get in the movies, sadly. "Beautiful she is, sir, lovely, sometimes like a great tree in flower, sometimes like a white daffodowndilly, small and slender-like, hard as diamonds, soft as moonlight, warm as sunlight, cold as frost in the stars, proud and far off as a snow mountain, and as merry as any lass I ever saw with daisies in her hair in springtime. But that's a lot of nonsense, and all wide of my mark. I'm really pleased that in the extended edition we get to see a little bit of Cate Blanchett doing her merry lass Galadriel in the gift-giving sequence. I think especially in the smile she gives to Gimli. Not just the sort of scary Galadriel that we've had mostly in the theatrical release. The filmmakers and John Rhys-Davies have talked several times about how impossible to film the giving of the three hairs would have been, the gift that Galadriel gives Gimli. They wouldn't have shown up on camera, and he would have had these thick gloves on that would have prevented him from doing anything useful with them. So they just had him describe receiving them to Legolas, which is a little bit of a letdown. As you can tell, I'm quite the fan of the Gimli-Galadriel interaction, so it's a bit of a disappointment not to get it on screen, but at least we do get, they do use the scene in a moment here to help depict the growing friendship between Gimli and Legolas. As it turns out, this was not the first time that Galadriel had been asked for some of her hair as a keepsake. In the Unfinished Tales, one of the many volumes of his father's writings that Christopher Tolkien has ushered into print over the years, the following passage appears, describing an event concerning Galadriel and her hair from the first age of Middle-earth. The Eldar said that the light of the two trees, Lorelin and Telperion, had been snared in her tresses. Many thought that this saying first gave to Fëanor the thought of imprisoning and blending the light of the trees that later took shape in his hands as the Silmarils. For Fëanor beheld the hair of Galadriel with wonder and delight. He begged three times for a tress, but Galadriel would not give him even one hair. So, that's just a nice example to me of the richness of Tolkien's backstory. You know, he really spent his entire life imagining the history that underlay these stories and this world. So, you know, something like that scene where Gimli, pressed by Galadriel to name, you know, to ask of what gift he would want of her, and he finally, you know, blushingly says, well, he won't even ask her, he's too shy for that, but he'll just name his desire since she's asking to, that he would request a single hair from her head. And the book's account of that whole passage is really wonderful, and highly recommended if you need a reason to read those books. Passages like that are a great example of just a richness to the story that you can never get from the film, despite the great job that the filmmakers did. I guess I'll mention just one more thing before I reluctantly relinquish the topic of Gimli and Galadriel. The fact that Gimli, this lowly dwarf of the mountains, was able to obtain her hair, you know, which certainly in British tradition is a significant gift for a woman to give to a suitor. The fact that he was able to obtain that when even Fëanor, who was arguably the most powerful elf king in history, the creator of the Silmarils, something that he could not obtain, it really puts that relationship of Galadriel and Gimli into a special light. And I will drop this, but if you find that sort of thing interesting, you should definitely check out the Library of Moria on the net at libraryofmoria.com. It's the premier site on the net for Tolkien-themed / fan fiction. And if you don't know what / is, well, just you can visit the site and find out. Here's another scene added for the extended edition. I think it was a good choice to remove it for the theatrical release. It's a nice addition. It helps to remind us of where the story is going and what's happening. And we do get another brief view of Gollum pushing the log along. But it's certainly something that can be left out, and the story will make sense without it. There's a little foreshadowing here of Sam and Frodo's relationship and Frodo's growing depression at the realization that he really needs to leave the Fellowship, that he can't take these people he loves with him to his death in Mordor. And this sequence with Aragorn and Boromir again helps move the story along somewhat. It's not essential, but it does give the actors a chance to highlight that debate within the Fellowship that was very much a part of the story in the books and does drive a good deal of the plot in this section. This part about hyping the Aragorn's hesitation to embrace the kingship is manufactured in the movie, not so much from the books. Again, you know, in my view, Aragorn has made his peace with that decision in the books. Here's a nice moment, though, that is straight from the books and is just brilliantly realized on film. The Argonath, I think, shows the great amount of thought that the filmmakers put into every aspect of the film, that sense of realism they were going for. They didn't just create these colossal statues as if they'd been hewn out of a single massive block of stone. They figured out how they might have actually been constructed, where the base of each statue is carved from the rock, but then the upper portions have been assembled using these massive blocks with the rock then carved away. And you can really see this as the camera swoops by. The statues are described in the book as being the likenesses of Isildur and Anarion, the two sons of Elendil, though I think in looking at these statues that the filmmakers opted to present Elendil, the bearded statue on the right there, and Isildur, his clean-shaven son, was the one on the left. At least the two statues look a bit like those two characters from the opening prologue sequence. And since there is no mention of Anarion anywhere in the movies, I think we can assume that the filmmakers just eliminated him in the interest of storytelling economy. So here we are beaching the boats above the Falls of Rohirrim, where the Fellowship will be rent asunder. They just do a nice job telling the story of the different characters, where they're at, Boromir and Frodo there especially. In a moment here, we'll have yet another ignoring of the advice of Legolas. And by this time, I think many people in the theater were ready to shout at the screen, "Pay attention to what Legolas is saying. Listen to Legolas." It's not discussed in the movie, but it is mentioned significantly in the book that the hill whose summit Frodo's going to be running to in a minute after his confrontation with Boromir is Emon Hen, the ancient hill of Sin, and by sitting in the seat at the top of it while wearing the ring, Frodo initiates a kind of magical telescopic vision. In the book, it's more detailed. He sees preparations for war being conducted in all the surrounding lands, and he looks to the south and he sees Minas Tirith standing proud and desperate, but then he looks to the east, and Tolkien writes, "Then at last his gaze was held, wall upon wall, battlement upon battlement, black, immeasurably strong, mountain of iron, gate of steel, tower of adamant, he saw it, Barad-dûr, fortress of Sauron, all hope left him." And the movie, it skips all of that, well, it skips right to the part where he sees Barad-dûr, and then goes to the next part, where he perceives the eye of Sauron looking for him, and he has to struggle to remove the ring before he's spotted. But first, before we get there, we have this scene with Boromir and Frodo, and I just love how this scene is handled in the movie. It's absolutely straight from the book. They realize it perfectly, and Sean Bean does, again, an amazing job conveying Boromir's emotions through this scene. Peter Jackson points out, as a side note, in the commentaries, that there was no scale effect at all used in the close shots coming up, where you see Boromir and Frodo together. On the longer shots, there's a scale double. One of the small people who are the Hobbit scale doubles is standing there with Sean Bean. But in shots like that, where you see Boromir in the foreground and Frodo in the background, or especially in the shot coming up where Boromir pursues Frodo and tackles him. It's really Sean Bean and Elijah Wood on screen with no special scale effects at all, which I gather was sort of a nice bit of liberating aspect of shooting this scene for the actors, not having to worry about that for once. And it just works out in terms of the camera angles, having Boromir in the foreground as he runs and tackles Frodo. You know, if you really look close, you can get a sense of the scale being a little off. But as I said back in my commentary in Disc 1, I think by this point, you know, you're so caught up in the characters, or at least I am, that I'm not that critical. There's the shot I'm talking about right there. Sean Bean is so good in this whole scene here. The part where he shouts at Frodo and then falls as if struck down and then gets up and is completely changed and suddenly the mad fit has left him is perfectly realized from the scene as given in the book. And I just love how Sean Bean handles it. There's so much pathos in the change of his expression and the leaves in his hair, and he's looking out and reduced to tears. It's just a heartbreaking moment. So here's Frodo atop Amon Hen, and again, the power of the ring is going to help confer this magical telescopic vision. And when he sits in this seat of kings here. And he's going to look out and zoom in rapidly on Barad-dûr and then see the Eye of Sauron seeking to locate him. Now, the book doesn't mention it here, but it is alluded to later, if you put the information together in the Two Towers, that Gandalf, who at this point is newly returned and restored to life from wherever he went after defeating the Balrog, Gandalf actually strove magically with Sauron in that scene. And managed to avert Sauron's gaze from Frodo just long enough for Frodo to remove the ring and escape being seen and revealed to Sauron. This meeting here between Frodo and Aragorn, in which Aragorn rejects the ring, doesn't happen in the book. In the book, Frodo just leaves without seeing any of the party again, except Sam. And clearly this handling the splitting of the fellowship this way works much better in terms of helping the film achieve a degree of closure. It's, you know, it's the kind of thing that maybe would not seem as realistic, because it isn't as realistic, this sequence of sort of staged meetings with these people he's leaving. Wouldn't make as much sense in the book, but in a movie it's forgivable. And certainly the acting in the scene is some of the... It is an important part of closing the emotional elements of the story and bringing the movie to something that feels like an ending, despite the fact that it's really just the beginning of two more films. You know, I've ragged a lot on Viggo Mortensen's acting, and I really don't mean it to be so harsh sounding. And in fact, in this moment coming up, the slow-mo shot as he faces the advancing Uruk-hai and salutes them with his sword before beginning this big final battle, I think is really great acting, and I think it's some of his finest moments as an actor in this film. This look right here, just the expression on his face, to me, it really conveys he's conquered his doubts finally. He's prepared to live up to his oath, to sacrifice his life to protect Frodo. And it's probably a tribute to the choices Peter Jackson and the other people adapting the story made in giving us the sort of wimpy Aragorn earlier on, that finally when he shows that resolve, it's gratifying to me as a viewer of the movie, even as one who found fault with their showing that lack of resolve earlier. Lots more excellent action sequences here, including some fairly comical tricks with the bow and arrow by Legolas. And again here, another missing from the book farewell meeting between Frodo and Pippin and Merry. I really love, by the way, in the movie, the way this interaction between Pippin and Merry plays out on screen. It really does convey the essence of their two characters. Pippin, the impulsive hobbit of action, and Merry, the smarter, more reflective one who puts it all together. In the books, especially the first few times I read it, Merry and Pippin kind of merged in my mind into sort of one composite hobbit extras character. But in the movie, I think they do a good job of distinguishing the two, and the actors do a good job of playing up the unique aspects of their personality. In a moment, we're going to get, here in the extended edition, the really ridiculous version of Legolas's rapid-fire arrow technique. We're going to see six separate arrows fired and find their marks in less than 10 seconds. And he has the seventh arrow knocked and ready to fire when we finally cut away. Orlando Bloom explains in the commentaries and elsewhere that his archery practice got him to the point where he could actually fire the arrows that fast, just without any hope of actually hitting anything. And so for these shots, he just pretended to shoot without using any actual arrows, and they just added CGI arrows afterwards. And here's Boromir coming to save the day, sort of his heroic moment. Here's the ridiculous sequence of shooting arrow after arrow after arrow. If you go on Google and search for the phrase "the boy with the bow," you can find a really nice website in which traditional archery enthusiast Ellen Brundage goes into raptures about Orlando Bloom's archery technique. I highly recommend it. This shot, by the way, I really love. There's this one long unbroken shot. We start off seeing Aragorn fighting, and we fly over this ravine full of running Uruk-hai. And we finish with an aerial view of Boromir fighting, and it's all in one unbroken shot. It's a little hard to see Boromir at the end, but they cut here to a clearer view of a clearer aerial shot of him to make it more obvious. And I think it's just a really cool way they used of putting you in the action, giving you that sense of motion, and helping you understand where everybody is in this action sequence. And that, of course, leads us into Boromir's final acts of heroism here. He's just taking out enemy after enemy, even as Lurtz, the Uruk leader, who's not named in the book. In fact, I don't think he's named anywhere in the movie, but he's necessary in the movie so we have a villain to dispatch. So he shows up and fills Boromir with arrows. I'm not sure where I first started seeing Lurtz referred to by name, but by the time I actually saw these movies, I'd read so many accounts by the filmmakers and other obsessive fans talking about Lurtz as a significant character that I just always recognized him as one and saw him as one as I watched the movie. In the book, Aragorn doesn't get in on any of this fighting going on here, or the fighting we've been seeing him doing earlier. He just comes upon Boromir not quite dead yet, after the Uruks have already run off with Merry and Pippin. It's one of those changes, though, that's justified by the needs of an action movie audience. Aragorn needs to be there, needs to take out Lurtz, I accept, in this final gratuitous beheading shot coming up, where the film would really end up being much less satisfying, feeling much less satisfying than it does, certainly for those not familiar with the books, and I think, in all honesty, even for someone like me. If you gave me the movie as if just shot directly from the book as described in the book, I might appreciate it on an intellectual level, but emotionally it wouldn't be satisfying. So again, I understand the need to have this ending, this climax as we're given it here. But still, it's an awfully good thing for Aragorn and for the film's climax that all those Uruk-hai here clear out so quickly, and none of them stick around to watch Lurtz finishing off Boromir. I've been talking over it here, but Sean Bean's performance throughout this whole sequence is just riveting to me every time I watch the movie. It doesn't matter how many times I watch it, it's just so impressive. And there's our action hero. And another sort of physics-defying but cool-looking effect with the shield pinning him to the tree there. This part in a moment where Aragorn sort of bats the thrown knife out of the air. They talk about it in the commentaries as something that that Viggo Mortensen actually did on location. That it's a well, it's not a real knife. It's a stunt knife, but it was actually thrown at him, and he did in fact bat it out of the air, supposedly with one take. And here's our final gratuitous beheading for this movie. Tolkien's version of this death scene between Aragorn and Boromir is fairly brief and doesn't get into all the deeper issues that the movie version does. Sean Bean has said that the original dialogue in the script was more plot-driven, which sounds like it was probably closer to Tolkien's version of the scene. But that the night before they filmed it, in a dinner meeting with Philippa Boyens and Fran Walsh, they reworked the scene, giving Boromir lines that felt more true to what he would be thinking about here in his final moments. Philippa Boyens, who is the most Tolkien-obsessed of the three screenwriters on the movie, says that she thinks Tolkien really failed to get at the heart of the emotion in this scene, and that the reworked version is better than Tolkien, which you gather, you know, from the way she says it is, a significant admission for her to make, but I think she's right. Certainly, the way they film as they filmed this scene, it's very powerful. And Sean Bean again is just incredible. It's a moving scene too, in the sense that, you know, we've all seen so many movie death scenes that are so sanitized in a way that don't, you know, look like people actually dying in any realistic sense, but the subtle changes they make with the grading of the colors of Sean Bean's face in the scene, and even the little extra touch they give and make him just a bit paler at the moment of death, which they talk about in the commentaries, I think really does bring home a more realistic sense of what death is like and what death looks like. You know, human beings are so attuned to skin tone that even very subtle changes in it affect us and communicate important information to us, and I think they do a great job with that in this scene. And it's just heartbreaking. The musical cue coming up, the way we settle down to just hearing the horns as we cut to Frodo standing on the shore of the lake with the ring in his hand, is my favorite moment from the soundtrack. Howard Shore, once again, doing it with horns, as he is wont to do. And they do a good job of giving us Legolas's and Gimli's respective reactions to Boromir's death. You know, Legolas with the incomprehension of the immortal elves for death like that, and Gimli is sort of taciturn, dwarvish response. Much is made in certain circles of the odd behavior of Frodo's tears in this scene. The long tear on his left cheek, the short one on the right, then they switch, then they go back. Personally, I don't mind. After all, we really don't know how long he stood there, and those shots could be momentary snapshots from a longer time spent standing on the bank, during which the tears stream down both cheeks. I've always loved the resolution Frodo shows in a moment when he reaches his decision and he strides forward, you know, puts the ring in his pocket, strides forward and launches the boat. As a lifelong sailor, someone who's done a fair amount of launching small boats off a beach, I admire his technique. And clearly the time that Elijah Wood and the rest of the cast spent in small boat training before the filming paid dividends. He really looks like someone who's been traveling down a river and is comfortable with these boats, and even more so, he looks like someone who's made up his mind after a difficult mental struggle, and now he's determined to get going. Good job. This shot of Sam running into the water is the one that they were filming when Sean Astin stepped on a broken bottle and seriously gashed the bottom of his foot. Be sure to check out the extra features for the documentary that shows how nasty it looked when they got his hobbit foot off, if that sort of thing appeals to you. You can see some real blood to go along with all the fake movie blood. What the book makes clear, more so than the movie, in several passages, is that Sam, like many hobbits, is terrified of water and drowning, which makes his commitment and his loyalty in this scene that much more impressive. You know, he doesn't hesitate. It's the thing he fears most, and he just strides right on in. I'm really impressed, by the way, by this special effect. I had no idea, until listening to the commentaries, that Sean Bean isn't actually underwater in this shot. They're just filming him in slow motion with a fan blowing upwards on him, and then they added in some digital bubbles. So I think it works great. And certainly a lot easier than trying to actually film underwater. I like, by the way, that in a moment, you'll see that they've cleaned up the whole issue of what Aragorn and Gimli and Legolas are going to do with Boromir's body. In the Two Towers, which is where that sequence occurs in the books, because they've shifted the dividing line between book and movie a little bit to help the closure for this movie. But anyway, in the Two Towers, the book, they spend hours, literally, dealing with Boromir's body, deciding what they're going to do with it, and actually transporting it, and just discussing it, and singing a dirge as they release the body to go over the waterfall. And of course, the whole time, Merry and Pippin are being carried farther and farther away by the Uruk-hai. And it's really quite a frustrating sequence, at least for me as a reader. But as I've thought about it over time, and here's the movie's much less painful, well, still painful in its own way, but much briefer version of that. But in thinking about it over the years that I've been reading these books, in Tolkien's defense, as a young man in World War I, he'd seen bodies left to rot on the battlefield. And if he chose to spend much of the rest of his life inhabiting an imaginary world where good and evil were sharply defined, and where the good were the sorts of people who would honor their fallen comrades regardless of the cost, I think I can forgive him that. More than one Tolkien fan has complained about this upcoming line of Aragorn's "Let's hunt some orc" as being too much of a Hollywood action movie one-liner, which it clearly is. But I think it's actually a fairly faithful condensation of Aragorn's speech from the book. Tolkien wrote Aragorn saying, "With hope or without hope, we will follow the trail of our enemies, and woe to them if we prove the swifter. We will make such a chase as shall be accounted a marvel among the three kindreds, elves, dwarves, and men. Forth, the three hunters." Now, I love that line in the book, that speech. And clearly it wouldn't work in a movie. But I appreciate and approve of the way they found a way to, again, serve the needs of both audiences. Echoing that line and that sentiment is an important point in the story, and they found a way to work it in a way that worked for the movie also. There's so much of Tolkien's original language that they found a way to work into the story in its original form, either in its original place in the story or in some other speech, some other or a different character elsewhere, that I'm completely willing to cut them some slack for the way they tightened that line up. This interaction here between Frodo and Sam, I think, is a perfect emotional grace note to the story. Sam's gentle, unshakable optimism, and Frodo's affection for Sam, and Sam's affection for Frodo, it comes through so powerfully in the expressions on the actors' faces in this scene. Maybe a little bit of the gauzy lens treatment helps kind of make it a little more poignant. On balance, I think this, the Fellowship of the Ring, really is the best of the three movies, at least if you look at it as a standalone film. Now, admittedly, as of today, when I'm recording this, it's something of an apples to oranges comparison, since the extended edition of The Return of the King won't be released for another month or so. And so I'm comparing to the theatrical version of that film. But certainly, this movie comes closest, in my mind, to being a complete movie in and of itself. After this movie, fans like me knew what to expect, and it became really just a matter of waiting for the next December 19th, or whatever the date was, for the next installment, which was difficult, but certainly not so nerve-wracking as that first wait had been. But sitting down to watch this movie, this was the first. And that uncertainty I felt going into the theater to watch it that first time, and the pure satisfaction I felt upon seeing the masterful job that everyone connected with this movie had done was something I will always remember. This concludes my unofficial commentary for the Lord of the Rings Fellowship of the Ring Extended Edition. If you have comments or feedback on any of this, or are interested in seeing other commentaries I might have recorded, you can go to my website at www.lies.com/DVD. Thanks for listening.